All right, now you understand why I had them sing it and not me. But hopefully, hearing the chapter being sung gave a little bit of an insight. So what do you notice immediately about chapter 128 as you were listening to it?
That it's perfect for a wedding.
It's perfect for a wedding. Right now you understand why they sing it under a chuppah. Eshtecha, your wife, kegefen poriah, she'll be like a fruitful vine, right? That your children, banecha, that they'll be like olive saplings. Okay. Anything about the tune? All right. Well, so let's dive right in. So again, we're on chapter 128. We just listened to the Breuer's choir singing it, and now you will listen to my interpretation of it, and I will spare you the song. So Shira Malos, right? Well, this is one of the Shira Malos. We've done. I think we did Kuf Chaf Aleph previously. Ashrei Kol Yirei Adonai. Ha'olech bidrachav. Praiseworthy is the one who fears God, ha'olech bidrachav, who walks in his path. Now, we've discussed the word ashrei before, right? And we're going to come back to the word ashrei. Ashrei in English can be translated as praiseworthy or happy. If you recall Rabbi Hirsch's magnificent interpretation, what did ashrei mean? Ashrei meant, he translated as a form of footsteps. In other words, when you're on a form of progression, right? When you're standing still, So that's not a good place to be in your life. But when you feel like you're progressing, when you feel like you're on an upward trajectory, that is a person who's ashrei. And again, we're going to come back to a lot of this, okay? Why the two words, kol yirei Adonai ha'olech bidrachav, someone who fears God and walks in his ways, aren't those the same thing? So the Radak points out they're not the same thing. That yirei Hashem, someone who fears God, that means he will refrain from doing, says the Radak, the losa says. In other words, someone who fears God is going to sit on Shabbos and not do anything. Someone who's ha'olech bidrachav, it's more of an active relationship to Torah, and that, he says, is the mitzvah saseh. Now, you actually have to go out and do things. It's not just enough to cower in the corner, but Judaism believes that you go out, and we have an obligation, a mission, a mandate to influence and impact the world. That's ha'olech bidrachav. We don't just sit in the corner and prevent ourselves from singing, but we go out into the world, and we emulate Hashem, and ultimately we bring Him in His presence into this world. Yigia kapecha kisochel, you enjoy the fruits of your labors. Ashrecha v'tovlach, praiseworthy and is good for you. Now, there's someone who does that. Eshtecha kegefen poriah b'ra kasei v'secha, banecha kishisilei zesim saviv l'shachanecha, beautiful imagery, that your wife is going to be like a vine within your house, that your children will be like an olive sapling around your table. So shall the man who fears God be blessed. Hashem will bless you from Tzion, Yerushalayim, right, Israel. And you'll see the goodness of Yerushalayim all the length of your days. And you will see children to your children, namely grandchildren. Shalom al Yisrael, may peace be amongst Israel. Okay, now that we've heard the song and we've read the words, if you had to summarize this chapter of Tehillim, what's it talking about?
Fearing God, maybe, Elias.
Fearing God, why do you think fearing God? My weekly Gigi shout out, so my mom knows that you're here, right? Why do you say fearing God? Because that's how the parak starts out, right? Ashrei kol yirei Adonai. Praiseworthy is the one who fears Hashem. Yeah.
If you melech bedrachav and you do all the mitzvot, then the land will be fruitful, your geshem will be on time, and it's sort of...
Right, so you're now focusing on this, right? So urei betuv Yerushalayim kol yimei yirvarech Hashem etzion, that Hashem will bless us from Tzion. So you pointed out, what is that blessing? So you're assuming that it's some form of a sustenance. Right, that God is going to bless us with
good
material
land.
Blessing, good land, similar to the second paragraph of Kriyat Shema. Summarize it in one sentence. Yeah?
Life cycle.
Oh, life cycle. Why do you say life cycle?
Because it starts with they're not even married, but it should happen, and she should be fruitful, and then you see children. So it's a full
circle.
So it's a full, right?
So Penny points out that, first of all, it refers to a spouse, then to children, and then in the last verse, it's grandchildren. So there's some form of a progression that's taking place here. Yeah.
I think the overall picture is it's painting a picture of peace. You have peace, all of this will progress.
So you have peace. Now, why do you say peace is the ultimate, or penultimate theme of this parakatilam.
It's hard to enjoy everything else unless you have the peace.
Correct. So the Gemara tells us that the kli machzik bracha, that the vessel to receive blessing, is shalom. Right? That's why almost everything that we finish with shalom. So what's the last paragraph of Shmon Esrei?
Sim shalom.
Right? Amavarach esamo Yisrael ba-shalom. Shalom is the last word. And the Gemara there points out that you could have all the blessing in the world, but if you lack peace, so there's no receptacle. It calls it a receptacle for the blessing. The blessings could be there, right? Imagine I have a big jar of to catch wine, and you're pouring the wine into my cup, but there's a hole on the bottom of the cup. So how much am I enjoying the wine?
Not much.
Well, my pants will enjoy the wine. Me, not so much. Okay? So the kli machzik bracha, the vessel that accepts blessing, is shalom. That if you have peace, then the Gemara tells us that is the receptacle. So you're pointing out that because we finish up Shalom al Yisrael, that that's the concluding words of this chapter, that peace is kind of that subtext, the meta-narrative that runs its way through everything. Okay? And I'll even take you a step further, building upon what Penny pointed out, which is that there's a progression taking place here. I would argue that the progression from verse 3 to verse 6 is if you have progression in your home, if you have peace in your home, that leads to peace in Israel, right? So we'll develop that a little bit more, okay? So we've developed a lot of themes. If I had to summarize it, I would say, what's the ideal life that I'm aspiring to, right? Because there's this balance here between spiritual benefit, enjoyment, and physical benefit and enjoyment, right? First, we talk about Ashrei Kol Yirei Hashem, Halech Bidrachav. That's all spiritual in nature.
Right.
My computer's still up there. And then you have Eshtechak Gefen Poriya, Beisecha. Then you have physical pleasure. So again, it's kind of that balance of what it is that the ideal life that I'm aspiring to. And ultimately what the chapter is about, I agree with Gigi, is it, what is the reward for being a Yirei Hashem? What is the reward for someone who adopts this lifestyle? Now what's interesting to point out is how does it start? What's the first word? Ashrei. Right, we assume that a Yirei Shamayim, that someone who has a fear of heaven. So, you know, that guy might have a ferbrenta face, he's walking around very serious, not right? No, Ashrei. That the whole point is that a life of Yirei Shamayim, a life of Olech B'drachav, isn't supposed to lead you to a life of misery. It's not supposed to make you sad and walk around all serious all day, but it's a feeling of Ashrei. And that we're supposed to feel that it's a praiseworthy experience, that we are the lucky beneficiaries of a lifestyle of a religion and a lifestyle of a connection to Hashem, to connection to the infinite, to a connection to something that extends beyond just us. On Shabbos, I'm going to talk about David Brooks's book, The Second Mountain, which I did not get to talk about on Tuesday night, but that's one of his themes. One of his themes is that that America is overwhelmed with the sense of hyper-individualism. Right, when we talk about the selfie and the iPhone, it's a intense focus on yourself. That's why social media and posting about myself. No one cares that you went to the bathroom 3 times today, right? I got news for you. Okay, but the world thinks that I care whether I went to the bathroom 3 times today. So we live in a world which is hyper individualism. Now, he points that's countercultural to the mentality of the 50s, where it was very focused on community and that there was a rigidity to that. And then in the 60s, there was like a breaking free of that, a countercultural, right? And he argues that that has not put us in a very successful position. And now we're coming back, and in order to find true happiness, we're coming back to connectivity. Okay, and that's kind of the central theme of his book. But that's Ashrei here, right? Ashrei means that you don't have to walk around as sad all day, but that's supposed to lead to a life of joy. And Brooks argues that the life of hyper-individualism hasn't led us to happiness, which we thought in the 60s would happen. Well, you thought in the 60s would happen. My parents thought in the 60s might happen. The me generation has not made us happier. It's made us more depressed, more anxious, right? More miserable. I can't tell you the amount of people I speak to on a regular basis that are unhappy. Okay, we live in an unhappy generation. And his argument is, or I would argue, that this is the response to it. Come on in. The response to this is Ashrei. That when we devote ourselves to a life that is beyond ourselves, whether it's giving to the other or whether it's connecting to something that's bigger to myself, or whether it's sacrificing to something that's bigger to myself, that gives me a sense of fulfillment. That's the word ashrei. Okay, verse number 2. Yigia kapecha kisochel, ashrecha v'tovlach. You will enjoy the fruits of your labor. Ashrecha, it is happy for you. V'tovlach, and it is good for you. Now, yigia kapecha, you'll enjoy the fruits of your labor. Is that true? Is that intuitive that I will enjoy the benefits of hard work?
Not necessarily.
So I'll give you a couple of examples how I know it's not necessarily true. The word avoda, which is the word for work in the Hebrew language, means what? Comes from what root?
Eved,
right? Slavery. Okay, work is a form of slavery. Okay, in Latin.
I thought avoda was prayer.
Well, prayer is a form of avoda.
Service.
Well, service in a good way there. But the word avoda comes from the word eved, which means you're a slave. Now, we believe we're a slave to God, so it's a good thing. Okay, but the connotation isn't exactly as exciting as we may have thought. The word labor comes from what word? The Latin word. It comes from the Latin word for drudgery. Okay, drudgery. You can look it up. I did it this morning. Okay, travail, which is a French word for work. Means what?
Travail,
whatever it is, yeah, okay. But travail comes from that, right? Travail. So what is that? That was an ancient instrument of torture. Okay, now why do I share all this? Because it's not intuitive that work has a positive connotation. Work can enslave you, right? Work can be a form of torture. Work can be a form of drudgery. So what are we talking about here? Yigia kapecha kisochel, that there's a positive benefit to the work that we do.
I just said that. I said avoda.
So, we're talking about avodat Hashem, okay? I don't know that that's necessarily obvious that that's what it's talking about here. Okay, I mean, if you look at the Meforshim, I don't know that all of them talk about it. Most of them talk about it in physical terms, right? How else do we know, by the way, that working is not a good thing? When was work introduced into the world? Hashem looks at Adam and says, "Ula Adam amar kishamata lekol ishtecha, because you listened to your wife's voice, v'tochal min eitz asher sivisichel imor lo sochal mimenu, because you did what you're not supposed to do, b'zeh asapecha tochal lechem, that you're going to have to work the land." Right? Work was not the ideal. Work was a punishment. It was a punishment. We know that to be true. So what are we talking about here? That yigia kapecha kisochel. So the Gemara already jumps in and points out and says, whoa, lest you think that work is a bad thing. Work has to be a good thing. How do we know? So the Gemara says, if you look at the first two psukim, you'll notice something interesting. It says, Amar Rav Chiya bar Ami, Mishmei De'ula, Gadol hane'enem yigia, yosir mi Yerushamayim. That the person who works hard, who benefits from his hard work, is better than the one who fears God, who fears heaven. How do we know? Because by the Yirei Shamayim, it says, Ashrei Ish Yirei As Hashem. That's pasuk number one. V'ilu gavei nena miyigia, but when we talk about benefiting from your hard work, what does it say? Yigia kapecha kisochel, ashrecha v'tovlach. Which is superfluous, right? Ashrecha, praiseworthy, and v'tovlach, and it'll be good for you. So the Gemara says, Ashrecha ba'olam hazeh, that Ashrecha means that you'll have joy, you'll benefit, you'll be happy in this world. V'tov lach le'olam haba, and it'll be beneficial in the world to come. What's interesting about the Gemara is what the Gemara is telling us is that hard work is ba'olam hazeh. We benefit from the fruits of our labor in this world. It's not even a reward that we're going to experience in the next world. But labor in and of itself, our hard work in and of itself, is the reward for our hard work. What does that mean? Now we know we have other comments of Chazal, which strike straight at the heart of this same point. For example, the Avoster of Nasan says, Yafa pam achas bitzar, mimea pa'amim bilotzar. That it's better to do a mitzvah one time with tzar. Tzar doesn't mean pain, it means investment. Investment, really. Emotional investment, physical investment, intellectual investment. So it's better to do it once with that emotional investment, mimea pa'amim bilotzar, than 100 times where you're simply cruising. Why would that be? I don't know that I would have intuited that. But that's what the Avos Torah Nasan says. Pirkei Avos tells us, Lefum Tzara Agra, that the extent of my effort, that is the reward. Pirkei Avos also tells us, Schar Mitzvah Mitzvah, that the reward for doing a mitzvah is the mitzvah. What does all that mean? So Rav Dessler points out in his Michta Meliyahu, he quotes Rav Chaim Ivelashen, that what does schar mitzvah mitzvah mean? What does it mean that the reward for the mitzvah is the mitzvah? It means exactly what we're talking about here. The reward for doing something sometimes is the self-satisfaction of having done the activity. Right? So I'll give you an example. My mother, when I grew up, I used to share a room with my brother. Okay? Now, you know, like the odd couple? So that was me and my brother. It still is. So my brother was like meticulous beyond meticulous, and I was a schlump beyond a schlump. It's actually ironic because I've, maybe it's my old age, now I've become a total like OCD knee freak.
That's probably your wife, not old age.
No, I'm actually, in fact, my wife and Matthew have a WhatsApp group chat where like they empathize with each other. I get in my cleaning modes and it's like, watch out. Because I'm like dumping stuff, throwing stuff in the garbage. So Matthew and Ariel will text each other like, oh boy, Phil's in a mood today, right? So I've now gone to the exact opposite extreme. Could be cramped in a small house with four little children creating a lot of mess. I just like need. But growing up, we were like the odd couple. My brother's half of the room would be meticulously clean and my half of the room would be a mile high with garbage. So eventually, I don't remember what age, my mom will, I'm sure I'll get a text in 20 minutes, but at some age, my brother was like, I can't handle it anymore. Phil and I can't share a room anymore. So they moved us into two separate rooms, but the way our house was structured, you had to walk through my room to get to my brother's room.
Oh my God.
So you literally had to like a pair of goggles with a walking stick and hiking boots to get through my room. And then like at the end, you know, like sometimes like the light gleams forth from the room. Like that was my brother's room, which was the light at the end of this dark tunnel. Okay? But here's what I've come to appreciate, which I didn't appreciate as a child. When you clean your room, or in our case, when you have someone cleaning your house, right? And you come home and that house is spotless.
Yeah.
What's the joy in cleaning that room? The joy is that you get to experience a clean room. In other words, no one is imposing the joy on you.
Right.
It's an inner joy that you experience from the clean room. So the joy of cleaning the room is the clean room itself. That's a mitzvah. Right? The joy of doing a mitzvah is the satisfaction of doing the mitzvah itself. Okay? That's what Rav Chaim Ivelashen says. And that's where Dessler develops this entire theory on all these ideas that we're talking about, which is that the reward for hard work isn't imposed by anyone else. It's not necessarily because when I work hard, someone else is going to come to me and shake my hand and say, Yasher Koach. The reward, the satisfaction is the work that I put in. That is the satisfaction that I feel towards my hard work. Okay? I give the example all the time of my microeconomics class, right? The first class I ever took in college, I came in, I was all cocky, I was all arrogant. I went to a great school and I went to Israel for 2 years. College was going to be a breeze. And I did miserably on my first microeconomics test. And I went to the teacher and I said, do I have any chance of getting a good grade? She said, I'll make a deal. If you ace the rest of the course, I'll give you an A in the class. And I worked really hard and I got an A in the class. If you ask me what my favorite class in college was, I'll tell you it was that microeconomics class. Why? It's not the grade. It's because I invested effort into that and therefore I drew a satisfaction from the fruits of my labor. That's Yegia Kapecha Kisochel. The satisfaction of your hard work isn't because someone else is going to tell you you did a great job. There is an inherent, innate satisfaction that comes with hard work. Now, parenthetically, I'll point out that this is totally lost on our generation. We've referenced this article in the past as well. It was an article in the New York Times, I believe, or the Wall Street Journal, but I believe it was the New York Times, called The Tyranny of Convenience. Some of you may have read it. I'm happy to send it to anyone, or you can Google it. The whole thesis of the article is that we live in a world now where everything is uber convenient. Right? Things are mechanical, things are outsourced, everything is basically handed to us on a silver platter. She describes, right, once you have used a washing machine, laundering clothes by hand seems irrational, even if it might be cheaper. After you've experienced streaming television, waiting to see a show at a prescribed hour seems silly, even a little bit undignified. to resist convenience, not only not to own a cell phone, not to Google, has come to require a certain dedication. In other words, our whole life is convenience. In fact, they came out with a study this week that people complain that one of the central struggles of our generation is the lack of patience. People are reporting that they are growingly impatient. Why?
Because they used everything.
They argue that within 16 seconds of not getting things done, people become impatient.
Instinct gratification.
Instinct gratification. So he points out in this article, he says, with its promise of smooth, effortless efficiency, it threatens to erase the sort of struggles and challenges that help give meaning to life. When we put effort into it, we derive a satisfaction. That's Yegia Kapecha Kisochel. That there's a satisfaction that comes with putting in effort. And if we live in a world that strips ourselves of that effort, so we also lose out on the satisfaction that comes with it. And therefore he says, there's so many things here. He says, today's cult of convenience fails to acknowledge that difficulty is a constitutive feature of human experience. Convenience is all destination and no journey. But climbing a mountain is different from taking the tram to the top, even if you end up at the same place. We are becoming people who care mainly or only about outcomes. We are at risk of making the most out of life experiences, a series of trolley rides. Struggle is not always a problem. Sometimes struggle is a solution. It can be the solution to the question of who you are. So let's reflect on the tyranny of convenience. Try more often to resist its stupefying power and see what happens. We must never forget the joy of doing something slow in something difficult. Right? The joy of Yegia Kapecha Kisochel. The satisfaction of not doing what is easiest. The constellation of inconvenient choices may be all that stands between us and a life of total, efficient conformity. So we have placed an effort on convenience, efficiency, technology, Google, right? Everything's made it easy for us. But he argues that we have robbed ourselves of the joy of struggle. And again, the name of the article is The Tyranny of Convenience. It's written by a man named Tim Wu. That is Yegia Kapecha Kisochel, right? The Ashrei Kol Yirei Hashem, happy, praiseworthy is the one who works hard. Ashrecha v'tovlach, Ashrecha ba'olam hazeh. In other words, the reward is not even in the world to come. The reward you experience for hard work is in this world. There's the joy, the satisfaction. You and I all know that, right? When we put effort into something. So there's a really great feeling for it.
There is.
Okay, there's something nice about going out to dinner.
Yeah.
Okay, and having a waiter wait on you and having the food handed to you on a silver platter.
Sometimes
or on a paper
on
platter.
The
but there's also something really nice about making the meal. Okay, we had this the other night. It was, I guess, Tuesday night or Monday night. Penny probably heard the yelling coming from her house because my kids were cramped up for way too long. In fact, I was on the phone with Rabbi Goldberg Tuesday afternoon and I had an interaction with one of my children. Rabbi Goldberg said, oh boy, those kids need to get to school. Right? So we made dinner as a family, which we never do because I'm never home and we never have time. There was like a joy in the house that night about eating that dinner.
You helped make the dinner?
I helped make the dinner. Right? I'll tell you, I know what my contribution. My kids made my kids love taco night. So every person had a different stage of the taco night. So my kids made the meat, right? Which basically meant taking it out of the package and sauteing it, which is a big deal. Okay. Ariel did like the rice, the avocado. What was my thing? So my kids were watching on some cooking channel, refried beans you need on a tostada. Anyways, usually we go to Trader Joe's and you can buy a kosher in a can, but Trader Joe's was closed that day. So when you didn't do a can, what do? You make your own refried beans. So I'm sitting online on Tuesday afternoon. How do you make homemade refried beans? Anyways, my kids enjoyed it. It was like the best meal. Why? Because every kid in every part of the family participated in making it. And there was a joy, there was an ashrei, there was a sense of accomplishment in the house. In fact, one of my children tried a new food that night that was like unheard of previously. And I realized, I told Ariel afterwards, I said, you know why? Because that child had participated, they had ownership of it.
Right.
They had ownership of it. What?
Who cleaned up?
Yeah, I'm not going to answer that. The general rule is, if you leave it into the sink until the next day, it mysteriously gets cleaned up between the hours of 8 and 5 when I come home from work. Okay? So fine. So that's Ashrecha v'tov lach. That's Yigia Kapecha. Okay? The next major idea that I want to develop is, if you think about this chapter, verse number 4 is a very confusing verse. How do they translate it on the sheet that I gave you? So shall the man who fears Hashem be blessed. Verse number 4 is a conclusion of the first 3 verses or an introduction to the last 2 verses. So the way they translate it, it's very clear that they view verse number 4 as what?
A bridge between the two?
I think it's a bridge too.
So it's funny, I first read it as a bridge. The way they translate it makes it seem like it's the end of verses 1 through 3, right? Verses 1, 2, 3, Hinei ki kein yivorak gaver yirei Adonai, so shall the man who fears the Lord be blessed. In other words, if you do all these things, we started off with blessing and we end up with blessing. And then verse 5 and 6 is taking it from a micro level to a macro level. Perhaps they didn't translate it correctly. In that there are really 2 different halves to this chapter. And I think this holds the key to the entire Parakatilla. Half number 1 is verses 1 through 3. Half number 2 is verse 4 through 6. Now, how do I know that? How do I know there are 2 halves? Because there are 2 different, what's the word I'm looking for? Persons that this, grammatically, stylistically, that this chapter works. Okay, runs. So let's start with verse Aleph. Ashrei kol yirei Adonai olech b'derechav. What person is that in? Blessed is the one.
Singular.
Well, no, you're in third person. Third person. You're talking about, right? Blessed is the person. Okay. Right. Then you go into verses 2 and 3, and it's yigia kapecha, that you will enjoy, which is now we're in second person. So we've gone from third person in verse number 1 to second person in verses 2 and 3. Verse number 4 is back to which person?
The husband.
So shall the one. Who are we talking about? We're in third person again. And then, Yivarechecha, Hashem will bless you. We're back to the second person. Interesting. So verses 1 and verse 4 are in the third person. And verses 2 and 3 in verses 5 and 6 are in the second person. Okay, so that already, stylistically, gives us a little bit of an inkling of insight that maybe, just maybe, verses 1 and 4 are headers, and 2 and 3 is one block, and 5 and 6 is another block. And if that's the case, then verse 4, like some of you suggested, is really the opening of the second half of our chapter. Okay, now how do you read these 2 halves? So there are 2 ways that I saw you can read these 2 halves. Way number 1 is basically, I'll call it the penny approach, which is that there's a continuum. There's some form of a continuation flowing from half number 1, which is again verses 1 through 3, to half number 2, which is verse 4 and 5. And what do you notice immediately between verses 1 through 3 and 4 through 6 is 1 through 3 is much more on a micro level, and 5 through 6 is on a macro level. So 1 through 3 is talking about a spouse, children. Where's the focus? Beisecha, Shulchanecha. It's a focus on the home. Verses 5 and 6, the focus is on what? Zion, Yerushalayim, Shalom al Yisrael. So it expands it, both in scope, right? You're going from your house to the world, and in duration, as you pointed out. You go from children to grandchildren. So I almost envision like an image of like a balloon blowing up. That's how I read this chapter of Tehillim. It starts as a very small, and then it expands until we get to the end. The Malbim points out that this is not accidental. He says the following. He says, okay. Verse number 4 of the Malbim says, Rotz Lomar, Ma shedibarti arata hu ma shenogei lebirchas hagever ba'atzmo. Verses 1 through 3 is the blessing that a person enjoys as an individual. Ki birchas ishto vanav nogela birchaso. That's all personal, individual forms of blessing. Ki me'ata, however, verse number 4 says the Malbim, yatchil daber ala bracha hayotzeit chutz mimenu. the bracha that extends beyond you. Which basically means the following. That if you want to change the world, where do you start?
Self.
You start with yourself. And then you change your family, in your house, in your children. And then you change your community, right? There's that very famous quote about that, which I don't remember the exact, but we all know what we're talking about, right? You want to change the world, you change whatever. So that's exactly what he's talking about. The first few verses are talking about changing yourself, impacting, influencing yourself. And what he's saying is, says the Malbim, that when you focus on that, that will have an impact, and it will grow into an impact on the world around you. He says, Kol yimei chayecha, shetiyached kol yimecha letovas haklal, liros tovam viashram. That when you slowly build up your sphere of influence, so then you will be able to change the world around you. Okay? The greatest example of this for me is an idea I once heard. I was at, it was a retirement party for my family's rabbi. His name is Rabbi Salomon Freilich. He was a rabbi in the Yonkers. And Rabbi Weinreb spoke at his retirement party. And he spoke about the Ner Ma'aravi, the western candle of the menorah. Now, the Gemara tells us that the Ner Ma'aravi was an edut, it was a testimony to the entire world that the Shekhinah dwelled amongst the people. Why was it a testimony? So the Gemara says that the westernmost candle was lit first and yet remained lit the longest. And that's a miracle, because we would not have assumed, scientifically that would not be the case. So the fact that it stayed lit the longest, that was a miracle, and that was a reminder to the Jewish people. Rabbi Weinreb asked, how is that a testimony in the entire world? How many people saw the menorah on a daily basis? Kohanim. Right? You and I didn't get to see the menorah. Jews in Timbuktu didn't get to see the menorah. So how is a little candle sitting in the base of Mikdash a testimony to the entire world? So what Rabbi Weinreb said, that from a Jewish perspective, heroism, influence, impact, creating light into the world doesn't necessarily mean that you're standing on a mountaintop screaming about God and Judaism. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're doing things that make the front pages of the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, or you're getting 100,000 likes on Facebook, right? Judaism believes that things can have enormous impact even when they're in the hidden confines of your house, right? When you create Kedusha, when you bring light into the world, even if it's in your own home, we believe that that light can generate an impact that extends far beyond you, okay? That's how the Ner Ma'aravi, which was lit in the Beis HaMikdash, was an aegis to the entire world. That the light that we generate in private is able to radiate far behind. Okay? How else do I know that? Arguably, the greatest moment of sacrifice in history, in world history, was what? We're going to read about it in a few weeks. Akedat Yitzchak. Okay, Avram Avinu. That is the paradigmatic moment of what it means to be a Kiddush Hashem, to sanctify God's name. How many people saw it? Two.
Well,
two people.
Avram
and Yitzchak. Avram and Yitzchak saw it. And yet, it's an action that has generated influence until this very day. How is that possible? Right? How many likes did Avram get afterwards? Right? He didn't get any. But that's the whole point. We don't judge things based on how much publicity they get. Even something when you're in the confines of your own home, when nobody else is looking, if you create an act of Kedusha, if you bring a little bit of light into the world, that is able to radiate far, far beyond you. So that's what the Malbim is talking about here, right? That it starts with Beisecha, Shulchanecha, the small things you do around your house to create Kedusha, to generate holiness, that can ultimately extend and influence into the world around you. The Malbim then takes it a step further. He says it's a little bit more than that. What it's also a message to, he said, "Shetiyached kol yamecha letovas haklal, liros tovam veashram." Our focus can't just be on ourselves. Our focus has to be on other people as well. Okay? When we sit down for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur davening, when we sit down on a Thursday morning to daven, we don't just think about ourselves, but we think about other people as well. It's the way I start off, none of you are there, but the way I start off Rosh Hashanah every single year, so we always speak for about 5-10 minutes in between Mincha and Marav of Rosh Hashanah. And to me, that's the hardest transition because there's no like Kol Nidre to get you into the mood. 1 second you're like at home with screaming kids, then you're at mincha, which is nothing spectacular, and 2 seconds later it's Rosh Hashanah. And the transition is very hard. So I reference every year in the social, I said, you know, Judaism is funny. There's no ball drop, there's no thunder and lightning and pomp and circumstance. Our new year starts like that. And all of a sudden, all of the trials and tribulations and successes and challenges of the previous year are gone. And we fundamentally believe that in the space of a minute, a new year has come with full of possibilities and opportunities and ways to change. Okay? But one of the things that I tell them every year on Rosh Hashanah is not just to daven for yourself. But if you want your davening to be impactful, you have to think about other people as well. The Gemara says that. The Gemara in Bracha says that there are two contradictory statements in Tehillim. One that says Hashem gets angry every single day. And then the Gemara says that there's a different pasuk that says when Hashem gets angry, none of us stand a choice. None of us stand a chance. So how is that possible? If Hashem gets angry every single day, and when Hashem gets angry, none of us stand a chance, how are we still here? The Gemara answers, no. We're talking about two different people. When you're only as an individual, then yes, you don't stand a chance. But when you're not just individual, but you stand there as part of a community, then you're able to stand before the judgment of Hashem. Okay, there's a comment. I believe it's the Rush. The Rush, Rabbeinu Rush, one of the great Rishonim. So I believe it was him that he used to get Shlishi every single Shabbos. And on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, he refused to get an Aliyah. Why wouldn't he want an Aliyah? He didn't want to stand out. Right? He didn't want to focus on himself. He wanted to blend in with the masses. He felt that if I blend in with the masses, then if I carry with me the merits of the Jewish people as a whole, so I'm much more likely to succeed than if I stand alone on my own merits. Right? And that's the way we approach Rosh Hashanah. And that's, as the Malbim, is the evolution of this chapter. Right? That we go from the individual to the community, both in the sense of our influence, that first we impact our Beisecha and Shulchanecha, and we believe that ultimately will impact Sion and Yerushalayim. And number two is it's our mindset, that we don't just think about ourselves, but we think about others as well. There's another difference, though, I believe, between these two halves.
Question.
Yeah, sorry.
If I may.
Yeah, of course.
This is the answer to why people say, I can daven at home, I don't need to daven. It is the answer right there. Community.
Well, how's that community? They just want to daven at home.
No, that's why you need a community.
You should.
I see.
Yes, that is why. Whether it's not always possible, obviously, but in an ideal sense, davening is in the plural, right? It's always extending you beyond yourself to think about other people, right? When you daven in a community, it's oftentimes more meaningful and powerful, right? When you feel that strength of the community lifting you up. It's why Ne'ilah, I mean, there are many reasons why Ne'ilah is such a great prayer, but I personally love it because it's the only time of the year when people who otherwise aren't into davening, everyone's into it. Mm-hmm. Okay? And you really feel that even when you're at your weakest, you feel like you're walking on air. Why? Because it's the power of the community. It's the singing of the community that lifts you up and that keeps you going. So 100%. 100%. And David Brooks would argue that's what's lacking in our generation, is that when people have lost that sense of community, they think they can take community and transport it online. It doesn't work, right? You and I both know that there's something about being with another person that is enormously uplifting and gives a person an enormous amount of strength. There's another difference, I think, between these two halves. And that is that each half, again, half number one is Pasuk 1 through 3. Half number 2 is Pesukim 4 through 6. There's one word in each of them that repeats itself. Which word is that? It's a different word in each one.
A different word.
I thought also.
Well, so yes, that word does appear, but there's a word that appears twice in verses 1 through 3 and a separate word that appears twice in verses 4 through 6.
Chayecha? No. Oh, vanecha and... No. Yeah, and vanecha.
Tovo ashrecha.
No. It appears twice in 1 through 3. And then
twice.
It's,
oh, 1, 2,
Ashrei, right? Ashrei.
Yeah.
Okay, so in verse Aleph, it's Ashrei Kol Yirei Hashem. And in verse number 2, it's Ashrecha.
Right.
Okay? And then in Psukim 4 through 6, it's the root word Bet Reish Chaf, Barech. Hinei Kichein Yivarach, and then Yivarechecha Hashem. Okay? Now, Ashrei in Yivarechecha or Bairach mean what? What does Ashrei mean?
Happy.
Happy. What does Bairach mean?
Blessed.
Blessed. What's the difference between happy and blessed?
If you're happy, then you're blessed.
Is that necessarily true?
You're blessed, you're happy.
So many of the commentaries point out that there is an inherent difference between our usage of the word Ashrei and our usage of the word Bairach. Ashrei, let's give some examples. Think back to our very first class in all of Tehillim, for those of you who are here. What's the first word of Tehillim? Ashrei ha'ish. Asher lo alach be'atzas ha'sha'im. Praiseworthy is the one who does not walk in the way of the wicked. And what does that parak talk about? Right? Kim besorah. It talks about the way you're supposed to live your life. Now, what is the ashrei of living that life? This comes back to what we were discussing earlier. What is the joy? What is the happiness? Is that someone else telling me I should be happy?
Yourself.
It's an inherent happiness. It's a happiness that's born out of my inherent satisfaction of living a certain lifestyle. Okay, we have that in chapter Kuf Mem Dalet, Pasuk Tesvav, where David HaMelech says, Ashrei ha'am shekachalo. Ashrei am she'adonai Elohav. Happy is the nation that this is the case. Again, talking about the way we live our lives. Ashrei am she'adonai Elohav. Happy is the nation that Hashem is their God. Okay? Where does that happiness come from? Who tells me that I'm supposed to be happy? The answer is nobody. It's exactly what we're talking about with Yegia Kapecha Kisochel Ashrechev Tovla. The happiness comes from the inside. It's an innate, inherent form of satisfaction. It's an internal happiness. It's the good that's found within me. Bareich Yivarechecha happens when? Right? I'm blessed when someone else blesses me. Okay? Hine kichein yivarach. You will be blessed. Who's the one who's blessing you? It's Hashem who's blessing me. Yivarechecha Hashem mitzion. Hashem is blessing me on the outside. So Ashrei is the satisfaction and contentment what comes with living an honorable lifestyle. Okay? And that's our Rav Dessler analogy of the clean room. That the joy of the clean room is the clean room itself. And the second verse is that Hashem will bestow blessing upon us. Those are, the Perek of Tehillim is telling us, two different levels. Right? We don't just do things because of an external sense of reward and punishment. We don't just do things because we have this faith that God is going to reward us for our good deeds. We do things because of Ashrei. We do things because of that internal sense of satisfaction and contentment that comes with living that honorable life. And I believe that's what the two halves of this chapter are teaching us. Is don't just, right, Al tiyu avadim hameshamshin asarav amanas lekaba pras. Don't just serve Hashem because you think that there's going to be this yivarach or yivarechecha, right? That will come. We have that commitment and that guarantee from Hashem. But ultimately, what gives us the greatest sense of satisfaction? It's the ashrei kol yirei Hashem. It's the ashrecha v'tovlach. It's that innate internal sense of satisfaction and contentment.
And also, and when it says ashrei kol yirei Hashem haholech b'drachav, in the beginning it's the ashrei. You also have haholech b'drachav. When it says yirech, it's just yirei Hashem. It doesn't have to repeat the haholech b'drachav.
So why not? Good. Why not? I think you just proved the point.
Right.
Right. What's holech bidrachav?
That you have to go out and actually.
You have to do it. You have to put an effort. And when you put an effort, that's ashrei.
Already you're blessed. You know, Hashem doesn't have to see that anymore because you're already at that place.
And that's the ashrecha v'tovlach. That's what the Gemara says. Ashrecha ba'olam hazeh. The fulfillment, the happiness we feel is because holech bidrachav, because I put an effort. In Pasuk 4, hine kichein yivarach gaver yirei Adonai. It's almost like God is blessing me. But again, it's external to myself, right? It's not necessarily a direct correlation, 100%. So I think those are some of the themes that we talk about when we talk about this chapter. It's a lot about the ideal life that we aspire to. I think personally, the imagery of this chapter of Tehillim is magnificent, right? We didn't even discuss why the imagery is used, why the the wife or the spouse around the table is kegefen poriar, is like a vineyard, a grape, is like a fruitful vine, and the children are like olive saplings, right? Why couldn't it have just extended the same imagery? Okay, so the Malbim talks about that. He says that a grapevine, so he says that shagam sheomid biyar ksei habayis yagvia anafav v'talasav ad gag habayis. You ever see a grapevine? Right? Yeah. Some people, right? What does it do? It surrounds the house. So that's the Malbim's proof that even though someone could be in the house, their influence can protect the house as a whole. Again, think of that. It's a beautiful imagery, I think, of
nice.
of the vines protecting the house. Olives, he pointed out, again, this is just the Malbim, but he says, why does it switch to olives by children? He says, because olives can't be grafted. Shein mekablam harkava. Menosnin shemen lama'or. Kain yezera emes me'irim bor hadas v'yoshin. That there should be a purity, that there should be, the same way you don't graft an olive tree, so to our children should be ungrafted. So too, they should be authentic. They should be truthful. Right. There should be a sincerity and a genuine nature to them. Okay, so that's as the Malbim is why you have that imagery. But again, just to summarize some of the themes that we spoke about. Theme number one is we spoke about this concept of hard work, the satisfaction that comes with hard work, and disconnecting ourselves from this tyranny of convenience. Convenience is a good thing, but we should never rob ourselves of the joy of putting in effort. Theme number two we spoke about was this beautiful, magnificent Malbim, which is that the things that we do in the confines of our own home, in the privacy of our home, can actually extend far beyond and can impact and influence the world beyond us. Being a religious Jew doesn't mean necessarily you always have to be on a mountaintop screaming, but even the moments of Kedusha, that when we're alone in the privacy of our home, can extend and influence and radiate far beyond our home. We spoke about how we don't just think about ourselves, but we think about other people as well, right? That's all the evolution from the first half to the second half. And then lastly, we spoke about the difference between Ashrei and Yivarechecha, that whereas Yivarechecha, Hashem will bless us, that's an external reward system. Ultimately, what should drive us is that internal, innate sense of satisfaction and drive. In fact, Daniel Pink, if anyone wants a great book recommendation, he wrote a book called Drive. Right. And the whole thesis of the book is exactly this notion, where he talks about external reward versus internal reward. He says, when you think about education, when you and I grew up, it was all about external. It was the stick and the carrot, right? If there was a reward for it, I did it. If not, I didn't. We know scientifically, I mean, the studies have shown now, that is not a long-term approach to reward, right? That might produce short-term reward, but that's not what's going to convince a person to do it after the carrot and the stick are no longer there.
I raised my children wrong. That's how I raised them, positive reinforcement. Like,
so there's a place for that. But he says ultimately, and this is what Daniel Pink's entire thesis, ultimately, if you want someone to continue doing something, there has to be that internal, innate sense of satisfaction. We feel that in Judaism also, right? If our Judaism is just do's and don'ts, right, and we're afraid of being punished, we'll do it. But the second we have a chance to chuck it, we'll relish that opportunity. But if you feel that sense of ashrei, if you feel to start to finish where we started, that living this lifestyle and buying into this system is the reward itself, and we find that satisfaction and content that comes with that effort, so that is the ultimate ashrei. That is ultimately what you and I aspire to.